Hey Toasties, welcome to this episode of Pyro Toasty Talks. This is episode 5B, where we will be talking about how we do markets from the point of view of David and Renee. I am going to be your MC for tonight. This is Zona and Brian from BZ Furfur, and we will be interviewing David and Renee from It's David and Renee.
Hey.
All right, so Miss Renee, Mr. David.
Yes.
Tell us, how do you set up for a market?
How do we set up?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, okay, let's see. So we have a big 10 by 10 white vinyl tent. We got a trim line, that's the brand. It's a trim line tent. It's super heavy duty, it's very professional, it was V expensive. It's like 200 pounds in and of itself. Like, it is a massive thing. So we set that up first. And then once that is up and grounded, whether it's like staked into the ground or weighed down with tent weights, whatever, then we start hauling in the tables. We set up the tables. And then, of course, everything just kind of naturally proceeds. You know, you put on the tablecloths, you start laying out the merchandise. We have panels that hang from the walls of the tent, so we can move those around, and we start, you know, just kind of eyeballing where we want things. But usually before we set up, we have a plan of how we want to set up. And every time we set up at a show, it's different because we are always playing with our display. We're playing with how we want things to look. And we still haven't figured out the perfect solution for some of the things that we have. So every single time we set up is different, but that's just generally like the process. We have our tent, we put that up, tables, and then merch.
I just want to piggyback off of that a little bit. All of our, so like we start quote unquote setting up for the show. Like, our prep work begins fully, like, the day before we even drive down. A lot of times Renee has all the art laid out in the house and kind of pre-plans how she wants it displayed. And then we get it packed in a convenient way. Because even though we have a minivan, we fill that sucker to the top. And then we get down to the show, and then it's a lot easier to work from the pre-planned ideas.
Yeah. And sometimes whenever I have the things laid out, I'll take pictures of how I want them. So then on the morning of setup or the afternoon, whatever, of setup, I can show David, hey, this is how I want this set up. So he can work on that and I can work on this. And he knows exactly how I wanted it.
That's actually a really good tip right there. I may it have is to good, steal yeah. that from you.
Yeah.
Well,
it just takes extra time to do it though.
We have to get out of the habit of Zona's usually still making product the night
Same.
Before.
Same. So this is part of why all of the stuff is laid out in the house. So, okay, number one, we have a wall in our living room that is my art wall. And when we come home from shows, my art doesn't sit in the tote down in the basement. I will unpack all of my art and put it back up on the wall. So I'm looking at my own art in my own house 90% of the time, other than when it's going to a show. So to pack up, I have to take all of the art off the wall and bring the totes up from the basement and then start loading in the pieces and wrapping them up. So like all of that's laid out, but I'm also making pieces and product up until the last possible minute. So I have things that are still drying, things that are still curing. I have things that I need to sign. I try to make sure everything is signed. I have my signature on everything. So like my stuff is just everywhere. It consumes the entire house before a show.
You also have started doing, cause Zona and Brian, you guys were talking about like making sure you get all your pricing done on the day of the show and like have time to set up and put the price tags on anything. We have like a thermal printer for shipping labels for a lot of our stuff, and I think Renee also uses it to print out like a whole bunch of the price tags before we even get down there, and then it's a lot easier to do that, like, it's to stay ahead of it. So you're not pricing like 100 new items when you're trying to set up for the tent as well. We also have been driving like 4 hours to the shows, so a lot of the pricing can sometimes be done in the car.
Okay, about the label thingy. So for my pieces, like my big art pieces, we have the thermal shipper or thermal label printer. It's not a Rollo. It's like a Munbin one. It's an off-brand one from Amazon. It was $100, and I do all the shipping labels, but I also got smaller square stickers. They're like 2-inch by 2-inch, and I will put those in, and then in Canva, I make my price tag, and they all have like the same formula. So I name my pieces, and that's in bold up on the top of the sticker, and then I have the medium description, so it'll be like watercolor on hand burned pyrography art on handmade birch panel or handmade cherry panel, burned by Renee, made by David, or whatever. Like, I have a little description, and then I have the price. So in Canva, I will just duplicate that and then change the details, and then I can export it and print it off, and it just like they all come out of the thermal label printer. And then I rip them off. Last time I put them on little cards, so I had like extra cardstock that I had cut 2-inch by 2-inch little squares, and I just put them on, and then I used scotch tape to tape them to the back side of the piece, but underneath it, so it hung out. So like there's the piece, and then the tag is flipped on the bottom, so it's like hanging underneath it, so you can see it. So people don't have to like touch the pieces, or I don't have to be like, oh, it's on the back. Like it's labeled and it's there. And the idea with that is, number one, so people don't have to touch or risk messing it up, because people are always like, oh, I don't want to touch it. Can you look for the price for me? You know, whatever. So it's just the easy being able to look at it and immediately know the price and the name of it. But also it kind of elevates my display a little bit, because it kind of looks like a gallery. Like when you go into a gallery, there's like the piece, and then there's like the little placard note, you know, off to the side that says it gives you the information about the piece, the name, the date, the author, the artist, you know, whatever the medium is. And so that was kind of my inspiration for doing it that way.
That's a really interesting thought.
I can do a YouTube video on it sometime.
Now, do you, when you do the placards, mm-hmm. do you take them off the piece and then add them back on again before the next show?
Create
a new one? Okay.
No, so the way they're taped, I can just flip them underneath it. So whenever I'm packing everything in the tote, I just flip the card underneath it and it's still taped. And then I can just stack my pieces and they're good to go. The only time I need to take it off is if I change anything. So if I change the price, or if I decide to rename it something, which I've done that before, I've changed the name of the piece, then I'll just reprint and then retape.
Mm. That's interesting. That's actually a really good tip. I do realize that the first question I should have asked you was, how long have you guys been doing markets?
How long have we been doing shows? So we started doing shows in 2018. Our very first one was a Christ Kindlemart Christmas market. And then we've just been doing more, not markets. We've kind of changed our game from markets and little pop-up shows to juried shows. And for those of you who might not really be familiar with that, juried shows are a little bit more prestigious, and they usually have a jury who you have to submit pictures of your work. And sometimes it's kind of like a little artist resume that goes along with your application. They review it. They look at the pictures of your art, and then they decide if you're going to be in their show or not. So it's like you're going before a jury, and then they let you know if you've been accepted. And like I said, they're a little bit more prestigious, because the judges usually have a standard of a show in mind that they want all of their artists to reach. They have a certain level of professionalism that they're going for. They have a certain vibe. It really just kind of comes down to the overall feel and presentation of your booth, of you as a human. And sometimes it's kind of like an interview. Like, they will check out your social medias. They will see if you're professional. They will see...
Not for the jury. After the jury approves you sometimes. Sorry. Some shows, I think, maybe do it before the jury, but a lot of times they want nothing identifiable with the pictures of the artwork so that they aren't, like, the jury can't be accused of, like, racial bias or anything.
Yes, but some of them do. Some of them don't care. Like, they'll ask you, what is your website? What are your socials? And they'll go look and, you know, they want to see what you look like. They want to see what your art looks like, what your setup looks like, how you present yourself.
Sure. I mean, they're all different.
Not all of them do that, but some do.
How do you find juried shows? Because that's one of the biggest challenges that we've encountered.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a... I know that there's certain websites where you can put your portfolio... And then you can submit to juried shows. I know sometimes they have their own websites. Sometimes you have to go through third parties. What's mm-hmm. the best way that you've found to connect with juried shows that are looking for this particular type of artwork?
So the number one website that we've used is Zap. It's Zaplication. It's application, but with a Z at the front. and I think it's Zap for short, zap.com. That is, I don't know if it's international, but at least here in the States, it is encompassing all of the states and different organizations, different councils, different artist groups, whatever, can put application. It's kind of like Indeed, but for artists. So you make a profile and you upload pictures of your artwork, you upload pictures of your booth, and there are different artist statements that they require, and you basically... fill out your little application, and they all have a fee that's associated with them. You pay the fee, and then your application goes through, and they will review it by a certain date, and they'll tell you if you're accepted or not. And then, you know, you go from there. You follow the directions of whatever they need for the show. But yeah, Zap is pretty easy. I really like that one. But as for other things, a lot of it just comes down to your local area. Like, if you have... like, okay, so here in central Pennsylvania, Lancaster is, you know, 40 minutes from us, and they have a renowned show that we had never heard of until we saw it on Zap, and we're like, oh my gosh, that's like right there in Lancaster. Like, how come we never heard of that? So, like, you might not know that there are these things going around in your area, but you'll see them online. And then sometimes vice versa, you'll hear about, oh, there's this show, but they don't post on Zaplication. You're not going to find it on Zaplication. You're going to have to, like, go to HarrisburgCity.com events, Capona Festival, because that's just not listed. You know, it's like that employer doesn't use Indeed to post their job listings. It's that organization doesn't use Zap to post their things. So you have to kind of keep your eyes and your ears open and talk to people.
Do you find social media helpful with finding applications for jury shows?
No, not for me, not personally. Like, there are some organizations that I have followed because I know of them, but they haven't really been, quote, helpful in finding. So, like, for example, we have a Nature Art Center Preserve kind of thing. It's called the Ned Smith Art Ned Smith Center. It's, I don't know, 40 minutes from us in the opposite direction. And we've been there before for one of their gallery expositions. And so I follow them, but I had heard from someone else online that they have an art festival, but I didn't even know that they had an art festival because it's not on their social media. So it's like, okay, well, there's social media for them, but I didn't even know because you don't talk about it on there.
We've started to join like guilds and other art mm-hmm. communities, that seems to be a good way to kind of get information firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know, like, if that's easier for us because we're right near a fairly big city.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, the further you are from, you know, a major metropolitan area, if that gets harder.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, like Philadelphia, there may be, you know, more than, you know, more groups like that than, you know, the part of Pennsylvania you're in. And I don't know if that's a deterrent or what.
There probably are other groups. There is one that we were a part of for 1 year. It's called the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen. Mm-hmm. But it's not just craftsmen. I mean, it's artists and fine artists. And they put on multiple juried shows in the Philly area. But I didn't even know that we had the Pennsylvania. It's statewide. It's not just like our area or just Philly. Like, it's statewide. They have different chapters in the different counties and such. And we had joined. But we only had heard about them because we were on Zap looking up shows in our area, and they host their events through Zap, and you can't apply for their event unless you're a member of the guild. So it was like, oh, well, I want to apply to this show, but I have to be a member of this guild. So I guess I'll go to this guild's website and register. And like, I didn't even know that that was a thing in our area. So that is something that I would recommend for people. Like, Google your city's name or your area's name, like artist guild, and see what comes up, because y'all have the Charlotte Guild of Artists. The
Guild of Charlotte Artists, yeah.
Guild of Charlotte Artists. Ours was called the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen. So like, they'll all have different names, but they will have events and things like that. So that's a good idea, Brian.
What was the best show that you've ever done?
I'm going to let David answer that.
Why?
Because you didn't like my answer last time, and I want to hear what you're going to say first.
For the best show?
Yeah, what's the best show we've done from your point of view?
I think it depends entirely on whether... It depends on what you're counting for.
Just in general, like the best one, whatever that means to you.
I think I agree with you that Port Warwick was the best one for... Like, overall, that was the one I enjoyed the most.
Okay.
But
it wasn't the most profitable.
No, the most profitable one was also one of the ones I enjoyed the least.
Yeah.
But that's... So, like, our most profitable one was this one with the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen in Philadelphia. But it's also, like, there was no... I tell you what, for having to be a member of the guild, there was very little support associated with that show. And that's actually something that I really value from the juried shows we go to, is like, if I'm paying $500 to be here, like, I would like more support from the management of this show than just like, I don't know, find your own space. Like,
oof.
Here's a number and three city blocks. Good luck.
Oh, like, damn, really?
Yeah, it was huge. So
I'm
like
referring more to the, here's a number, good luck.
Yeah. So like Port Warwick was one of the first ones we had done. It was the first one we did south of the Mason-Dixon line. And apparently down in the south, they're much more accommodating to their artists.
They're real nice down there.
Yeah. They were like, we'll buy you dinner. Here's some breakfast. Like, you know, let us know if you need anything. Somebody stayed late with us during teardown to help make sure we got everything back into the van, mm-hmm. Which was nice because it was one of those spots where you had to park like too far away for just carrying things.
I will say a little bit goes a long way with the organizers. Mm-hmm. So just coming by halfway through, especially on a long day or a hot day, coming by with bottles of water to hand out to the vendors, or a snack, or, you know, like coming by to each of the booths and explaining to you what the exit procedures are, like that stuff, it's means so much more than I think a lot of the organizers give credit to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I don't, I mean, we are pretty self-sufficient, so a lot of that stuff doesn't apply to us, but like we were talking when you guys did your episode on this about how hard it would be to do a show by yourself. And like the one we did in Philadelphia would have been impossible because they didn't provide like booth sitters for you, so you would have had to be leaving your booth relatively unattended if you ever needed to like pee, which required walking a block to one of the places you were allowed to use a public restroom.
Yeah, they didn't have any porta potties or anything. You had to go into the Barnes and Noble or like the local coffee shop.
Ooh.
I know.
And sometimes those places are just like for customers only.
Right.
So, like if you want to they use their bathroom, deal. Like.
Yeah, they had talked with the Barnes and Noble and you had to wear your artist badge, but like not everyone who might be with you has an artist badge. Like I have a badge because I'm the artist, but like if I had brought my mother-in-law with me to help, she wouldn't have had an artist badge.
Side note on badge drama. Okay, so this is a thing that happens at juried shows is because they are prestigious. They want you to know who the artist is. And so the artist always gets a name badge. And so Renee always gets like Renee Foskett, artist. And then sometimes they give you badges for like other people that might be with you if you provide the names, and they're never like also a cool guy artist man. It's always like helper, assistant. Oh,
David Wilson, helper.
David Wilson, dude, I know
he has such a complex about it, and I think it's so funny. I know. But yeah.
Get yourself a what is that little printer that you have that you can stick things on?
The Dymo.
Yeah, get yourself one of those little Dymo label makers and print out like a really cool title for yourself and put and, it like, over wherever it says assistant. Yeah, assistant.
We have one. I can bring it next time.
Wood assistant czar.
Czar. Oh, I like that.
I don't need a super cool title. I don't need to be better than Renee. I just need, like, also relevant in the production of this art.
Wood czar.
I love it.
I like that. I kind of like that. I feel like maybe we should, like, sneak that into some of the Pyro Toasty Tark artwork or something.
I'll make it a hashtag.
There we go.
Hashtag wood czar.
There we go.
The wood czar bazaar. That could be an event.
It sure could.
Okay.
The event where all of the Timber Turtles get to come to the shop and buy whatever's just lying around.
They would love that. It's like an estate sale for the shop.
Yeah.
all Timber Doodlers descend on the Foskettleson house.
Blow the layer off. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
This piece of wood's been back here for 30 years.
But there's some wood in there that's like special, like from your mom's barn or your mom's farm.
Yeah.
And that walnut tree. Like, yeah. Okay, so anyway, that's about our best show. Now our worst show.
Dun, 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 dun.
I mean, I think we already talked about it a little bit. It's that one in Philadelphia. Emotionally, the one in Philadelphia, the Rittenhouse show, was the worst. It was the best profit, but emotionally was terrible. And I think we've talked about it on this podcast before a little bit, but it was like just everything about that experience that could go wrong did go wrong. And then I guess if we didn't include that one, our worst profit, we've had a couple of zero shows. So usually
negative shows.
Oof, those yeah, suck.
Those
that
are
sucks
the,
so hard.
Negative yeah. shows really suck.
They suck so hard on so many different levels, not just monetarily, but like emotionally and mentally and just like spiritually, for lack of a better term, right? Just like, ugh.
I just want to just something to say to the listeners. If you have a show that is a zero profit show, if you have a show that bombs, if you have a show where everybody seems to be doing well and you're not selling anything, do not take it personal. Make it about you. It is not you who is it's not a failure on your part. It is not something that you did wrong. Sometimes you just have bad days. And I know how hard that is, and I know how disheartening it is. And I just hope that if that is your first show and that happens, that it doesn't deter you from going and doing more shows, because they will get better. And there are always going to be ups and downs.
Always going to be ups and downs. Yeah, especially if it's your first show. Because I know that feeling. Like, we've been to shows where other people, it was their first show ever, and it sucked for them. And they're, like, leaving in tears. And, like, you want to give up. And they're like, wow, this totally sucks. I'm not doing this again. Like, but if you, again, if you take the emotion out of it and you look at it logically, this was a brand new business endeavor that you tried. It didn't go well, but that doesn't mean that it's a failure. Let's try again. Let's change some things. Let's, you know, maybe analyze what went wrong and maybe see why it went wrong. Was it bad weather? Was it, like, there could have been so many things outside of your control, but there could also be things within your control. So maybe change your setup, maybe change the way you, like, display your things. You know, like, there are a lot of things that you can change and you can control. So just look at it from that point of view and be like, okay, this wasn't a failure. This is a learning experience. How can I move forward? But you are probably going to cry for, like, a day, and that's okay. Just don't keep crying.
You should share your Renee has like a business pick me up thing that she thinks about whenever we're having a bad show. And I don't know.
Do? Yeah, you talk about Mr. Hershey himself.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we live in central Pennsylvania. We're like 25 minutes from Hershey. And I've been to Hershey World so many times. Every time we have someone who comes up to visit us, whether that's my mom or one of my besties or even you guys, we always go to Hershey. Because people, like, it's a thing people know and people want to, like, experience, like, it's Hershey. So anyway, there's a trolley tour that they do at Hershey World where they take you around the city of Hershey and they tell the story of Milton Hershey, how he came to build this huge Hershey empire. But Mr. Hershey failed so many freaking times. And I have heard this story on the trolley ride because I've ridden that trolley like 8 times. Like, I know his story. And he failed. He went bankrupt. He moved across the country. He went bankrupt multiple times. He put his whole life on the line multiple times for his business ideas and his caramel business, or caramel. I don't know how you say it. I say caramel. But he tried caramels and they failed. And, like, it took him years and so many bankruptcies before he finally made it. And now he has this Hershey legacy. He has the Hershey School. He has the Hershey Trust. He has the entire city of Hershey. He's done so much and his legacy lives on. And so whenever I'm having really shitty days at a show or whatever, like, I think about Milton Hershey because I'm like, he failed so many times, but, like, the man never gave up. So I have to give props to him. And, like, I hope he's not, like, rolling over in his grave at my rudimentary tale of his story. But, like, I think about that a lot. And it's a story that I've heard over and over again. And I'm like, I can relate to that. Like, I feel like I have put so much into this business. We've invested thousands into this business. And, like, sometimes it just feels like it's failing and I don't know why. Like, why do I give up? And it's like, well, Mr. Hershey didn't give up, even though he wanted to. Like, my man's risked everything, but he didn't give up. And so it's like, okay, I'm gonna stick this one through, and maybe next time will be my golden ticket. But yeah, that's what I think of. I think of the Hershey story.
And it's not even that it's going to be a golden ticket, right? Like, because it's not like just one day you go from...
Right, it doesn't just fix your everything.
Yeah. It's progressive. It's, you know, it. And then you look back, and when you look back at a year ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and you compare where you are now to where you are then, you get perspective as to, you know, what has improved and where there still needs to be improvement. But, you know, it's I don't think, like, we look at you guys and we're like, man, these guys got it together. You know, it's like, They know what they're doing. You know, they're not like us, just kind of, you know,
fumbling through.
I feel that way about other people. I look at them and I'm like, man, they have it so together, and I'm just over here like fumbling every day. Like, what the F is even happening?
But it's all perspective. It's perspective, and you know, like you were saying earlier about learning experiences, right? Like that first market bombed,
mm-hmm.
but clearly you were at a market at some point that was like booming, right? You were at some market and you saw how busy it was, and you looked at a vendor and said, man, they're doing really well, because something made you think that you could start a business.
That you could do it too.
That you could do it. That right. You could have that booth that was doing so well. Mm-hmm. So that one market that was not well was it's like you said, take the emotion out of it and be like, well, this one sucked for us. However, something somewhere, some market at some point in your life made you think that you could do it. And that was a good market. So maybe mm-hmm. this market is not the market, but it's got to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's a matter of picking yourself up by your bootstraps and keep yep, on trucking. And
trying again.
But it's so hard some days.
Oh my gosh. It is so hard.
It is so hard.
And we're really blessed that we have some savings that we can use to try things. Like mm-hmm. when we took the investment to try the juried show, like here's the thing. That juried show in Philadelphia cost us over $1,000 to be there. And I know some people listening to this are going to shit a brick because they're like, holy crap, you spent $1,000. I can't even make $200. Like, how do you do that? Well, you have to have some kind of savings and you have to bite the bullet to invest. And it takes a lot. It takes a lot of materials. You have to have a nice tent. You have to have the money for the application. You have to have the money for the booth. You have to have the money to travel. If you have a full-time job elsewhere, you have to take the time off. It's mm-hmm. a lot. And so if you don't have that to invest, then it feels like you're stuck or, you know, you're never going to get to that level. But there are things that you can do where you are right now to help you. So I don't want to steer people wrong or give people the wrong idea and that like juried shows is where it's at and you need to do them. Like, no, not everybody has the means to do that. And that is so fine. You will find your people in other places where you are at. And you will find ways that make it work for you. Like maybe that means you don't go out of state. Whereas David and I, we don't have other full-time jobs, so we can go out of state. We can leave on a Thursday to have a Friday, Saturday, Sunday show. You know, like we have my mother-in-law who willingly watches the dogs, so we don't have to have dog care. We don't have kids, so we don't need child care. You know, like we have the ability to do those things, but a lot of people don't. So I want to encourage you to take the emotion out of it and look at it logically. What can you do with your business where you are?
I think that I think networking also helps with that, because we've spoken to people who have told us about like the GCA. Someone else told us about the Guild of Charlotte Artists, right? Mm-hmm. And they suggested it. And they suggested other leagues and they suggested other things. And we looked it up and we were just like, well, hell, how did we not know about this? And we put in for it. And like the Guild of Charlotte Artists is, they promote their members. And that's one thing I will mm-hmm. definitely say. Like we tag them and they will respond. They will promote
They share
us.
Your stuff.
They share our mm-hmm. stuff.
I've seen it right? in their stories.
And like to join the art show that I'm in right now, comparatively speaking, chump change. I mean, $25 is still $25, yes. However, like compared to like what we pay for a market or whatever, right? It still puts us out there, right? Mm-hmm. Like in we're there, and I wandered around and I just listened to people because, you know, I just wanna sneak around, and I do like the unbiased opinions that people will give when they don't know that the artist is there. Mm-hmm. And that could be a good thing or a bad thing. We had a conversation about that before. Mm-hmm. But it's also good to know, like, what people think, and they've said it like, oh my God, did you see that? And that's different. And, you know, that's really unique. And you get a little bit of perspective. So that's kind of like a nice little pat on the back. And, you know, it kind of validates you, right? And, but, you know, but then you have conversations, you make the networks, and they're sitting there saying, oh, you should check this out. Check out this gallery. Check out that gallery. They may or may not be up your alley, but maybe they are. Maybe you just check them out. But, I mean, that's also part of the networking, and that is what you know, Brian's the best at a market. But yeah,
we've actually gotten invited to other shows by talking to people who are at markets who happen to be on panels or other things for other shows. And they're like, oh, well, you know, if you're interested, we've got this show coming up at the Whitewater Center. If you'd like to be a part of that. Oh, yeah, sounds great. And then you connect with them afterwards. And now we're, you know, in this other show. So,
We've had similar things happen where people come up. And we even had one lady who was like, I work at the, what was it?
Just now?
The Norfolk Botanical Gardens.
Yeah, we have to see if we can actually make that one happen.
And they're like, we're having a mushroom festival and I'm the marketing person or whatever. And you would be perfect. Like, do you want to be a vendor? And it's like, ooh, that sounds fun, you know, but like, yeah, people come up and they're part of something else.
So what sells best for you at shows?
That's so hard to quantify and to really label. Because every show is different and every show has a different audience. But I have found what sells best for us at shows, it's really hard to quantify or to think about or categorize because it depends on the audience. It depends on who's there. It depends on the clientele. So like when we were doing the Christ Kindle Mart, we did that for what, 5 years, 4 or 5 years. And that's obviously at Christmas time, our Christmas ornaments were the number one seller at all of those events. The cutting boards, not so much, but Christmas ornaments, that was the number one thing. And we made hundreds and hundreds of dollars off of Christmas ornaments. But at the rest of the time of the year, Christmas ornaments don't sell at all because it's not Christmas time. You know what I mean? At the Port Warwick show, my big art was the number one seller. Like my most expensive pieces, I sold 3 of them at one show. And that just, that made show, that made booth, that made travel. Like it was awesome. So I would say that that was the best seller, even though that was only like 3 pieces. And we probably sold more bookmarks and wooden spoons quantity wise, but money wise, the big pieces is what made the show.
Yeah. We don't do very many like batched out pieces as much. Like most recently we did a whole bunch of like shelf sitters with those cats on them. I think we've talked about before,
which by the way, I have a YouTube video on our YouTube channel on how I did these rainbow cat shelf sitters. They're really cute. So you should check it out on our YouTube channel, just by the way.
Yes. And we sold like all 10 of the ones we bought like in the first day at this Norfolk show. So like that was really cool. And you could say that that was a bestseller. But, you know, we sell one or two big original pieces of art and it's blowing those out of the water. And we're really trying in the juried shows. We're trying to tailor the booth to sell those bigger pieces. And so, but if it's an original piece of art, it's like, well, is that the best? Like I sold one and I only have one. I can't sell another one to see if it's a bestseller, you know?
Well, okay. Well, would you say that like your overall, would you say that you sell a lot of the smaller pieces or finer art pieces overall?
I just did the like full show accounting the other day, so I can tell you that at Port Warwick, no, at Norfolk, it was like pretty much exactly 50-50 on small pieces. First day, we sold a bunch of small pieces, and then the second day, it was all bigger stuff because we were kind of out of small pieces that people wanted.
I think I had said to David at that show, I think if I had had like 5 times as many cat shelf sitters, I think I still would have sold all of them. Like, that is how popular and in demand and how fast they went off the shelf. And so by noon on the very first day of the show, I was out of small stuff. And it's like, well, that's a good problem to have. But also, if that's what sells, then I'm out. Like, so it was, that was very interesting because that had never happened to us before.
But historically, it's been all over the place, and we're really, like, because we want to move more of the big fine art pieces, we're trying to tailor the tent to display those a little bit better. And so we'll actually be looking at, like, revamping our display system for the next show. Because, like, the guy next to us was selling $3,000 paintings, and it's like, let's see if we can get some of his money. Like, where are those customers at?
Yeah.
And that's not a negative thing, right? I mean, you know, it's, you know, you're not, it's not, like, I don't think you're ever taking business away from another artist.
No.
By selling pieces, because, you know, people are going to buy what they want.
And everyone is different.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Every single person's different.
And I think, you know, being able to display your pieces in a way that's appealing and that draws people's eyes in and that, you know, makes them want to buy your pieces is an art in of itself.
It is. You have to have an eye for it. It's display psychology. If you've ever been in retail and you have to put displays together, like, yeah, Zona knows exactly what I'm talking about. There is a psychology, and there are a lot of YouTube videos. There are a lot of small business people out there who will give you really good advice on how to put together a good looking display. And what that means and what people are looking for subconsciously without even knowing it. But yeah, having a good display, you have to use your display space to your advantage to make it look the best that it can possibly look.
What would you say would be your least favorite piece to sell? What is the, I don't want to say worst selling.
I can tell you what the worst seller is, though.
Okay.
Cutting boards. Our cutting boards do not sell at all.
That's a shame.
It is, because they are beautiful. And it's not because my cutting boards suck or like someone else has, quote, better. I think it's because of the price, number one. People are just kind of put off by spending $75 on a cutting board or something, especially when they're not really looking for something like that. You know, if something catches their eye and they're like, oh, well, that's kind of cute. Like, how much is that? And then they see the price. They're like, holy shit, $95 cutting board. It's like, yeah. But the other thing is, people say they're too pretty to use. I would never cut on it. And that just, I know that's, so it's the price and it's the concept. People are okay cutting on a piece of wood that's just a piece of wood, just a wooden cutting board. But once you put a design on it, then it's like it's too pretty to use. And people don't, they're like, I'm going to mess it up. Like, over time, I'm going to mess up the burn. The burn's not going to look good anymore. The color's going to discolor. Like, if I had this, I would never use it because it's too pretty. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that breaks my heart, but it's also a compliment. Like, thank you. But also, no, like, I make these to be used, and there's beauty in using them over time, because it is a testament to all the meals you've cooked, all of the food that you've shared with your family, all of the love that's gone into your baking. You know, like, it tells the story of your kitchen. It tells the story of your family, of your cooking. And like, if you're sentimental about those kinds of things, then like, that could be a really nice, like, heirloom thing that you could have for the next 50 years in your kitchen, and that's special. But other people are like, they don't have that sentiment, or they just don't care, or whatever. And that's fine, like, different strokes for different folks. But
Zona came up with a good solution for that. When okay, say that, she just says, flip it over when you want to cut on it.
Yep, I say the same thing.
Flip it over to the other side when you want to display it.
Yep, that's exactly what I tell people. I'm like, I know it's really pretty, but you can always just cut on the back side and keep the front side pretty. Or you can, like, use the front side to display, or when you're not using it, you know, display it on your whatever. People have big kitchens. We don't have a big kitchen, so we don't have kitchen space to put things on display. But if you have kitchen counter space, put it on display. and just cut on the backside and make it the rule and make sure everybody else in the house knows you can only cut on the backside of this cutting board. Like, because it would really suck if your 11-year-old came into the kitchen and like cut up an apple on your cutting board that you're like prizing.
Trying to keep pretty.
Right, right, right. What were you going to say?
I don't know how much, like, at our... these expensive jury shows, if you're coming through and dropping $3,000 on a painting, do you cook? Like, do you cut your own apple up for dinner? Or is that like... I don't know. We started off with the cutting boards as a functional piece for the craft shows. But when we started moving to more juried fine art shows, they really have not moved since we moved up there. It's almost like they're too... in between on prices, like too expensive to be an impulse buy but not nice enough to be fine art that somebody actually wants to buy,
and they're too expensive to be gifts, because that's another thing. People come into our booth and people are always looking for gifts, especially around holiday seasons. Mm-hmm. But I can't justify buying an $85 cutting board for my niece, you know, like when the mm-hmm. budget is $40 a person. Sorry, I can't afford that. And like, that always, I don't lower my prices, but like, it does kind of break my heart a little bit, because I'm like, but it's so worth it. Like, it's literally, it's organic. You're not gonna have microplastics in your food. Like, it's gonna last you literally the rest of your life. Like, it's an heirloom kitchen thing. Like, oh, I just want people to see it the way I see it, but people just see it as like too expensive. And that's just like womp. So that's definitely the worst seller.
Well, okay. Well, that kind of segues into my next question for you.
Okay.
Who is your target audience?
Ooh, okay.
Or who would you like to be your target audience?
So we have different target audiences for different things. So in our business, it's David and Renee. We have three main avenues for revenue. We have three different revenue avenues. We have the wood supplies, and people who buy our wood supplies, almost all of them are pyrographers, you know, so that side of our business has a target audience. When we go to shows, we have a target audience because we're selling finished fine art. That's a totally different like subset of people. But then I also teach classes and stuff, and that has a target audience for who I'm trying to target to make sales for classes and such. But for shows specifically, I don't have a very fleshed out avatar like I do for the other two target audiences. So what I mean by avatar, it's like I try to come up with a profile of who this imaginary person is. That is like, who is my perfect customer? Who is that? It's probably going to be a fake person, but what do they look like? What do they do? How, like, why are they excited about your product? You know, there's a lot of psychology that goes into target audiences, because it is fundamental to selling. Whether you like it or not, you have to know who you're selling to. And I don't mean just like, I think women between 28 and 50, like, absolutely not. That is half the population. No, like, your target audience needs to be someone so specific that you know them like a best friend. And this person is not going to be every single customer. So if you're like, okay, well, I can't come up with just one person because so many people buy my stuff, just come up with one person. You're going to have all these different kinds of people who still buy your product, but who is your perfect, most ideal customer? What do they look like? Why do they buy your stuff? How much do they spend? You know, like, do they have the disposable income for your stuff? So that's kind of just a generalization of coming up with a quote avatar or a ideal customer profile. And you can find a lot of stuff and tutorials on how to do this online. And I definitely recommend doing that. But I haven't done that exercise for our shows. I've done it for teaching classes and for my wood supplies and the timber doodlers and stuff. They have very specific profile avatars. But if I have to kind of just give it some brain power right here, right now, target audience would be... Oh, God. Okay.
Do you feel like you need to give it brain power right here, right now?
I'm thinking if I can come up with something. So, like,
I just think it's going to be terrible audio.
So,
I think that with the profiles for mm-hmm. people at markets, it's tough because
it is.
You don't know who's going to show up at a show.
Right.
And, I mean, how do you, like, when you're thinking about creating, like, those profiles, usually that's for, well, this is who I want to target if I'm going to do like a Facebook, you know, campaign or an Instagram ad, or, you know, I want to target people between 30 and 45. And, you know, so it's really hard unless the organizers of the show are giving you those statistics of who's, you know, who's likely to be there.
Right.
I don't even know how you plan for that. It's very difficult.
It's so difficult. So, like, here's, oh, go ahead.
I would say the thing that I've seen the most is people arrange their booths to the income level that they're trying to target. So, like, the big $3,000 painter guy, his booth is all giant, like what am I trying to say,
he has like two huge, he called them his showstoppers, two huge showstopper statement pieces that are his most expensive. They're $5,000. They're smack in the middle of his wall, and then everything else that he has are smaller pieces, but he has maybe 12 total paintings hanging up in his booth. It's very minimum. It's very, like, this is what I offer. And I'll be damned, he sold his showstoppers. Like, there are people who are walking around with that money who saw that and was like, that $5,000 piece going above my mantle. Here's my checkbook. And it's like, holy shit, how do I get in on that? but he's setting up for the maximalist buyer. Like, he knows who's buying his stuff, and he knows what their income level is.
I just mean,
like, if he had those paintings in his booth, but also a ton of little things surrounding them, it presents a mixed idea for when people are walking by. Whereas if your booth is nothing but, like, giant statement pieces, then the people who are looking for giant statement pieces are going to come into your booth.
And the people who aren't, right. Which kind of coincides with what their pocketbook looks like.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of times people want to have a variety because they want to capture everyone. And as we move into the fine art show area, we're trying to experiment a little bit more with, like, really targeting somebody who's got $1,000 to drop on a piece. And, like, how do you target that person so that the little people coming in and thinking about whether or not they can afford to buy your $10 bookmark aren't in the way of that guy when he wants to buy your big piece?
Well, it's also just not my ideal. Like, my ideal art buyer would be someone who is so excited about my art, who doesn't try to haggle me on the price, who just loves it. Like the lady in Port Warwick, she loved my botanical head lady, that piece. She was just completely enthralled by it. She came up to it. She was like, can I touch? And I said yes. And she's rubbing her fingers on it. She's looking at the colors and she's just in awe. And she bought it and she went home with Botanical Lady. And like, that is my ideal customer. She came in and she was just infatuated with it immediately. I don't want someone who I have to convince. I don't want someone who I have to try to, like, sleazily convince you, like, well, it might not be here later, you know, you might want to get it now. Like, I don't want to have to do that. I want it to be so easy. I want you to love it so much. I want you to connect with the color. I want you to connect with the media. I want you to, like, be so in love with the burn like I am. Like, that's part of my ideal customer. I don't want someone who's just like, yeah, that's cool, I guess I'll take it. Like, no, like, that's not the vibe I'm going for. Not a vibe. You don't pass the vibe check. Like, but there are also other things. Like, I don't want you to have buyer's remorse about it. I want you to be confident in your purchase. Like, And of course, those are things that I can't control. Like, I can't control if she goes home and has buyer's remorse. That's not my responsibility to make sure she doesn't have buyer's remorse. It's her pocketbook. She needs to be responsible with her money. But, like, of course, I'm a people pleaser, and I don't want you. Like, I want you to be so confident and be, and like, this is it. I'm so stoked about this piece of art. And then
I feel you. Like, I when I make a piece of art, especially one that I'm in, like, I am in love with, mm-hmm. right? Like, I want whoever takes it home to be in love with it also.
Yeah,
like,
to they, love like, it as much like, as
they,
I do.
They looked at it and said, I don't care about that price sticker on the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want that piece. And then even when you tell them the price, they're just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's no question. There's no, ooh.
I know.
Think about it. You know, it's just, I am in love with this piece so much that it is no longer a want. It has become a need.
It has become a like, need I because need I've connected with it.
House. Exactly.
Yeah.
I want them, as an artist, I want people to see the things that I make. And I want it to spark an emotion. I want it to spark a thought. I want it to spark a love for it. And even if that exact piece isn't it, I've had people go, I love your work and I want this. Mm-hmm. Can you make me this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it strikes something in them. And then I I've done that, and I've had people just tell me, they've emailed me afterwards, I still stare at it and mm-hmm. I love it. I gave it and the recipient cried because it meant something. That's what I want.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to like what I was saying in a previous episode where it's like, I want them to cry because it's an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because to me, that is the validation that I want.
Mm-hmm.
That's the validation that I need as a person, as an artist, that I've made something that they
connect with so deeply. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to do some rapid fire tips? Do you have any tips that you want to give?
Ooh.
For people starting out with markets, people who are struggling with markets, people who don't know how to make those connections and, you know, can maybe learn from some of your experience?
I know as soon as we hang up, I'm going to be like, oh man, I should have said this, but give me a second to think. David, do you have, yes, David has something.
All right. First tip, buy the best tent you can afford to start out with. It's not a thing that you want to cheap out on. They should be white. If you think you're going to go to fine art shows ever, they should be white.
Because they almost always require them to be white.
Yes.
Yes.
Straight legged.
Yeah. And if you need.
Not the slanted leg.
Yes. And if you need a specific brand, we use a trim line. But I've seen better versions of the one we use. So ours is made out of steel and weighs like 400 pounds. and so, but I've seen people who have them made out of like a much lighter aluminum material or something. I didn't have the money for aluminum, I don't think, when we were first buying it. But if I did, I'd upgrade now.
I don't know, though, because ours was still an investment. Ours wasn't a $100 thing off of Amazon. Ours was $1,400. Like, ours was an investment that we saved for because we were tired of dealing with our dinky little tent.
Yeah, we got the dinky little one.
Yeah, like, and if you do, okay, so, like, if you do have a relatively cheap tent and that's just what you have right now, that's fine. You can still make it work, but check the seams, because the cheapy tents, the ones that you get off of Amazon, the ones that you get in the camping section at Walmart, you know, whatever, those seams are not waterproof. It will save you so much time and heartbreak and frustration if you get some water sealer tape and you can tape the seams on the outside and the inside, because in the event of rain or even just a hot, humid day with condensation, you're going to get drips, and there is nothing worse than getting a drip of water on a piece of art and it ruins it. If you have sealed stuff, it's not always a huge deal, but if you have unfinished work, if you don't put a sealer on your pieces or you have something raw wood, whatever, one drop is all it takes to ruin it. And mm-hmm. that has ruined that ruined so many pieces of my art that I was so freaking frustrated. I wanted to just say screw it and be done with it. I was so frustrated. So, but like, we could have avoided this if we had gotten waterproof tape and done the seams on the inside and outside of the tent, or gotten like waterproof spray. And, you know, you can spray and do some layers on the seams of the tent, but protection is a huge thing. David has another one.
As far as tent stuff too, this is another one. If you're in a place where it gets cold at night and the water might condense, like, think about where it's going to run. So if you've got a tent that doesn't have airflow at the top, we actually have had it freeze to the inside of the tent overnight, and then the next morning
we had icicles.
Yeah, it thaws and drips on your work, even though you have a really nice waterproof tent. Big suck if you're in the north.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
That makes sense. It's just not something I would ever have thought about.
Yeah. I don't know how much of a problem it would be for you guys where you are in North Carolina, but this was a Christmas one. This was our Chris Kindle Mart a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it got warm during the day, so it condensed at night, and then it froze, and then we had mini icicles on the inside of our waterproof tent. And it doesn't have anything to do with the waterproof tent, but we didn't have the ventilation flaps opened on the top of our tent, and that would have really helped with the airflow. But we forgot to do that for, I don't know, whatever reason. And then as the day warmed up in the morning, the icicles were melting and dripping all over the damn tent, and we were so frustrated. I think we had a beach towel. That's another that's a tip. Bring dirty towels. Like, not towels that are dirty, but towels that can be dirtied. So old beach towels, old guest towels, whatever, because you're going to get mud, you're going to get soggy shoes, you're going to get condensation or rain. You're going to need to wipe off the bottom of a bucket before you put it in your car. You're going to need, if you have the condensation problem or the dripping problem, you're going to need a way to get something that will absorb water up into the crevices of your tent. So one year we had, I don't know, someone had a broom. I don't know where we got the broom from, but we had like a broomstick, and we put the towel on the end of the broomstick and then shoved the broomstick up into the canopy of the tent, and was like, it was like we were banging on the ceiling of our upstairs neighbors, you know, like, don't, like, shut up, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. We were doing that, but to our tent, to try to catch all the raindrops that were dripping. It's like, it was a giant Q-tip, and we were wiping the underside of our canopy. Oh, go ahead.
This is another great one. If you're just starting out, and you don't have a ton of money, but you've got sweat equity that you can pour into things, outdoor shows that end in rain or have rain occurring, a lot of vendors we've seen have like purchased outdoor carpets or will purchase them just for those muddy shows to have like a 10x10 non-mud floor inside their tent. And then at the end of the show, they don't want to clean them, so they just throw them away, which there's not a big enough dumpster, so they're usually just sitting next to a trash can, and you can go and grab yourself, like, you can clean them, and now you have an outdoor carpet for your next show.
Yeah. This is true. We've done so many shows where it was rain or snow or whatever, and the mud accumulating in people's tents, because we're always in grass. That's just how it always is. We're like never on pavement. We're always in grass, and it's always a muddy slop fest. So much so that people will sometimes stop coming into booths if they're too muddy, because people don't want to be muddy.
Yeah, I remember going.
It's wild.
We went to a Greek fest, and it had rained, and it was lots of mud, lots of grass, and it was just, like you said, it was just like, oh, I really wanted to go in there, but
you're worried
I'm
that
about
you're
going to
slip and fall on your butt.
Besides slipping and falling, it's just like, who wants to walk around?
Who wants to be schlopped in mud?
3 inches of mud on their shoes.
Right, especially if you have kids or dogs or a stroller. Like, people aren't coming into your booth anymore. Like, mm-mm. Yeah.
I don't want to walk around with it. I don't want it in my car.
Correct.
Like, and then even trying to bring it home, I'm sitting there stressing, like, man, I'm going to get this in the mm-hmm. car, and then I'm going to bring it home. And then, you know, and like, these are the things that I think about, because mm-hmm. I don't want to have to clean that crap up later.
Right.
So, yeah. No, I get that. Though that's an interesting one.
For more rain prep, I have learned that on teardown day, if it's been rainy, I will wear my crappy clothes. Like, I wear my leggings that can get muddy, and I'll wear a t-shirt that I don't care if it gets muddy at the end because I'm getting in the car and coming home anyway. So, like, bring a change of clothes if it's going to be a muddy mess, or bring your muck boots or your rain boots so you can just take off your normal shoes and put those on so you don't have to worry about stepping in mud and getting your socks all wet. Bring towels, bring trash bags. Just be prepared for mud. Be prepared for the worst. Be prepared.
No, we should all be taking snake notes of that.
Isn't that from the
this
Lion King?
This will be part of the toolkit.
Yeah, toolkit.
The toolkit episode.
All right, two last ones. First off, real quick, if you're applying for a fine arts show and they don't tell you how they're going to advertise the show, they haven't done enough thinking about how they're going to get the customers into your booth. Most of the ones that you have to pay a big application fee for will tell you, like, we've taken out TV slots and, like, whatever. So if they're not telling you, they don't have a plan. And keep going.
But if they're not telling you, but you are interested, it is totally fine and kosher to email them and be like, hey, I have a question. What are you guys doing for advertising on your end? I didn't see anything. You know, it's fine to ask questions. Like, don't be shy. Don't be afraid to ask questions. It's literally your business and your money on the line. So take 10 minutes and type up an email and just ask the question. But yeah, the ones that are like, oh, we're doing social media, we have a Facebook event, we have an email subscriber list of over 15,000 people, we've taken out two, like, commercials, we have local newspapers, like, if they're telling you, you know, this is all we're doing for promoting this event, like, that's a good sign. That's a really good sign.
Last one's not really a tip. It's more of a controversial pet peeve, but I consider it a tip. Don't tear down early, because you never know if you're going to get that last minute sale. It's happened.
Oh, yes.
But two, everyone else that tore down early is going to clog up the parking lot for like the first hour after the show's over anyway. So save yourself the headache, tear down when you're supposed to, and just drive away in peace.
Also, sometimes when you tear down early, you run the risk of not being invited back.
They won't let you reapply again. Yep. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do the show again, don't do that.
I definitely agree with the whole don't tear down early. Like, we will milk it to the very
same
last minute.
You paid to be there. Like,
and I remember our first Pride. It ended. Well, first of all, the very first Pride that we did, we were under the neighborhood market, and it was one really, really big tent, and they didn't have light, and I was really annoyed that they didn't say, like, that there weren't going to be any lights in the tent. Like, I assumed that there would be lights, you know, so I didn't have any kind of lights. So there were no lights. It was getting dark, and we were just like, crap, what are we going to do? We were trying to stay until, like, I think it ended at 10, but it was just getting so dark, and everybody else had left, and, like, there was only one or two other vendors there. So we kind of, like, slowly started packing up, even though it was early, but there was like a handful of people who came in, and they were just like, oh, we didn't even know that this was here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were, we kind of left the stuff up while we were chatting. And then that very last sale made, like, because it was a 2-day thing, and like, you figure, okay, day one, you should be making this much. Day two, we should be making this much, right? That's kind of what we think of. That last sale made the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the very last sale.
Yep. You're going to have people who remember you or have been wanting to come back to your booth all day. And sometimes there are other vendors who checked you out earlier who are like, oh, I got to go see this lady before we pack up. And like, it'll be 7 p.m. and they run into your booth and they're like, oh, yes, you're still here. Thank God. I want that.
I got to go see the wood lady.
I know. Oh, the wood czar.
The wood czar.
Okay, I have two tips. Where'd the second one go? Now I just have one. If you're a water drinker, like, don't bring multiple water bottles. Just bring your one water bottle and a gallon of water. So that way you don't have to keep, like, going to a water fountain if you're indoors. And if you're outdoors, like, you don't have to go find a water fountain, and you don't have to carry around multiple water bottles. Just have a gallon of water. Oh, and the other one was a fanny pack. If you have, like, a little fanny pack it's so much easier to just put your immediate essentials in it and have it with you than like having to carry around your purse. Just have a fanny. Just have a little fanny pack.
If you're not one of the, if you're 50% of the population whose clothing hasn't been blessed with functional pockets.
Right, because women's pockets suck. But like, yeah, I'm just like, saying, like you have your phone, you have your keys, you have your wallet, like you might have feminine products, like just have your little fanny pack. You don't need to grab your purse every time you leave the tent. You know what I mean? Just saying. It's just so much easier.
I like that, functional pockets. Yes.
The functional pockets.
Completely side note. Why do they not make all women's clothing with functional effing pockets?
Actually,
I'm gonna go against the grain a little bit here, and I don't carry anything in my pockets when I'm at markets. I throw everything in a bag. It's just a little, you know, like crossover bag.
Okay.
Because when I'm lifting boxes, moving stuff around, the last thing I want is to drop my phone out of my pocket, or like, you know, like I'm sitting there hitting my, you know, like you're carrying these boxes and you've got the stuff, the keys in your pocket, and they're digging into your leg. And I just throw everything in a little crossover bag and carry it that way.
I feel like you are buying the wrong clothes or lifting incorrectly.
Oof.
I think that I have, they're very heavy totes, and they're very, very awkward to carry.
David is a man who has like 10 extra pounds of things in his pockets. So when, like, his pants are like 15 pounds. The man carries around a knife. He has his wallet. He has freaking rope. He used to carry around a notebook and a pen in one pocket. He has a tape measure. This is just his daily wear.
No.
He just carries this ish around. He's like, you never know when you're going to need a tape measure. I'm like,
That's what I keep in my crossover bag. I've got a Leatherman right. in there. I've got a notepad. I've got, you know, yeah. like...
Except he wears it. He wears protein it in bar. His pockets.
Keep a 200-calorie protein bar in
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Bottle of water. Like
too. You got to get yourself some Duluth pants. Listen, we're not sponsored by Duluth, but I would love to be. And get their cargo Duluth, pants though. And you'll thank me.
I love Duluth. I used to buy Duluth. I don't buy them anymore, but yes, Duluth. Mm.
All right. When do we get their podcast sponsorships? Because I'm actually, this is one we should pursue. I only own 5 pairs of pants because they're too expensive. Now, if they're giving them away...
I mean, but we'll get around to, I think, you know, we'll get around to sponsorships. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Anybody out there, we can sit here and start naming off people.
Listen, we're 5.5 episodes in. It's time for this to pay off for me personally and my pants right now.
Somebody get the Luth on the horn.
Alrighty. You have any questions? Any other questions or anything for us? I mean, I know there's so much more that we could talk about, but
I think you covered it. I think that you covered a lot of it in our in the last episode too. I think that there was a lot of crossover between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So unless there's anything else, I think we we're good.
Cool.
I did have a question, and then it ran off somewhere, and I don't know okay. where it went.
It'll come back.
It'll come back at like 3 a.m.
As soon as we start, we hit stop. It'll be like, oh, that was good.
I'll question. Pretend to hit stop.
That's how it works.
All right. Then you have to close us out, love.
Wow. So this is episode 5B of Pyro Toasty Talks, where we did a deep dive and then some on doing markets and shows from David and Renee's point of view, with lots of input from Brian and I, because that's what we do, because this is exactly what conversations between me and Renee are like all the time. But you can find us at on Instagram, BZ_furfur, for me and Brian, and it's David and Renee, one word, for it's David and Renee. And you can get us on bzfurfur.com, and it's davidandrenee.com, our Discord. And please, 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 please come join us on Discord. Drop us some questions. Give us some tidbits. Oh, God, I can't even talk straight. Feedback and tidbits of information. Hit us up with any questions, of, you know, ideas of any future podcast things that you would like to hear us talk about, or if you guys have any tips and tricks for markets and whatnot that we didn't cover or talk about. And as usual, stay toasty.
Stay toasty.